know you there. It's New Year's Day 2015. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Folk Runyon. And tonight, we present a discussion on the importance of Canaanite and or Phoenician mythology in magic, magical Kabbalah, and in Solomonic ceremonial magic. We will explore how it can relate to alchemy, astrology, and Hermetic solarism. We will discuss the alchemical symbolism of our Canaanite seasonal rites and the relation of Canaanite gods and goddesses to the Sumerian and the classical Greek pantheons. So, if you want to explore what lies behind the myth of Solomon being the master magician, tune in and we'll introduce you to the real old religion. Now, this is a very meaningful subject, especially after some of the discussions we've been having in previous weeks based on the Lost Gospel book that just recently came out. And what we've been doing, as those of you who have been following our presentations for the last few weeks, what we've been doing is we've been tracing the quest for the Holy Grail. We've been tracing the development of pagan gods and goddesses, especially the concept of the dying god or the year king. And we've been tracing this through all the way from Isis and Osiris and Baal and Astarte, all the way through into finally culminating with Jesus of Nazareth and Mary Magdalene, Mary the Lady of the Tower. And this is the model that we've been using to do this tracing work is a piece called the Nassim Document, which was recounted by a Dark Age, I say Dark Age, early medieval or Dark Age bishop, Christian bishop by the name of Hippolytus. And he recounted this Nicene Gnostic document in which these first century Gnostics traced the development, and of course they were professing to be Christians, like so many Gnostics at that time were, tracing the development of the dying gods that were reborn, either in the case of Isis, in the case of Osiris, he was reborn up in the other world and stood in judgment. But most in most of the ancient religions, they got started out, the god was reborn with the vegetation the next year, and we're tracing this along, as I said, all the way from Isis and Osiris and Baal and Astarte, all the way up through Jesus and Mary Magdalene as the last, kind of some of the revelations in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the Da Vinci Code, and the idea that Jesus, he probably did die on the cross, but that Mary Magdalene was in fact his wife and his priestess, and that she carried his child, and later either in southern France or over in Glastonbury, whether you are a British Arthurian Grail aficionado or whether you are a French, southern French Languedoc Grail aficionado, you recall, of course, in that in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, you know, King Arthur comes up to the French castle. And he looks up at this French knight up in the top of the tower in this French castle, and he says, "I say, do you have a Holy Grail?" And the French knight looks down at him, and he says, "Yes, we have a Holy Grail, and our Holy Grail is better than your Holy Grail, you stupid English person, you." And then he says, "I flatulate in your general direction," or worse to that effect. Anyway, so the French But curiously enough, in the Nicene document, at least Hippolytus's version of it, when he discusses the Gnostic Christian Marcus the Valentinian, and his priestess replicating Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and replicating the river up there in Lebanon where Baal was killed originally, and the river ran red in the spring, and Marcus Valentinian was replicating this in his communion, turning water into wine, and they did this in southern France. So at least the Nicene document is a Francophile Grail myth, and so I suppose that King Arthur wouldn't like that. But anyway, regardless of that, what we're going to discuss tonight and is the whole idea of the resurrection or transformation, either way you want to look at it, resurrection and transformation of ancient pagan gods and goddesses, and the revival of them, bringing them up into the Hermetic Kabbalah, and resurrecting, finding these ancient gods, and using them in modern ceremonial magic, and how important this is in a Jungian from a Jungian point of view, and also from the standpoint of activating our chakra system, because let's realize that Renaissance magicians, the founders of our Hermetic magical tradition, people like Pacino and Giordano Bruno and Campanella, these Renaissance Italian, especially magicians who started off the tradition of European ceremonial magic, they really were trying to bring back the classical, mostly Greco-Roman, classical pagan god forms and bring them back. And in fact, there is a very interesting book by a scholar by the name of Selzak called The Return of the Pagan Gods, and this involves the interest with the Hermetic scholars and the magicians in the Renaissance in resurrecting the classical pantheon. Now, how does the classical pantheon relate to the Canaanite pantheon? Well, we'll get into that. But the key idea is that our early ceremonial magicians, who were certainly considered themselves to be Christians. Now, of course, if they didn't consider themselves to be Christians, they were in trouble. But so they wanted very, very much to restore classical paganism in the realm of magic. And so they began equating the idea of, which they got from the Sabaeans over in Iran, and we'll discuss that pretty shortly, but they got the idea of attributing, and the Zohar helped him do this, of attributing the ancient classical gods and goddesses to the planets. Well, you know, we have that in astrology, for heaven's sake, which is one of the bedrocks of Hermetic magic, is our planets are all named after classical pagan gods. Well, when do you think this naming took place? Well, during the Alexandrian period, with Ptolemy, the father of astrology, that's when we started naming the planets after the gods. It comes from a much earlier tradition. It goes all the way back, as a matter of fact, it goes all the way back to ancient Sumer and Babylon, is the naming of the planets after the gods. You know, who knows how long Ishtar has been Venus, and of course Nergal was Mars, so this tradition of naming the planets after the pagan gods. Now, I'll point out also that the planets, as Ficino and many of the Renaissance magicians realized. The planets were inside us. We all, on the principle of as above, so below. The planets not only represent the spheres of the Kabbalistic tree of life, but they also represent the chakras within us. And on this show, we have discussed the differences between the Eastern arrangement, the Indian arrangement, and our Western arrangement, where up and down the spine we have these chakras, and in the West they are a straight relationship to the planets, whereas in the East they move them all around for different reasons because they use an alchemical relationship. Now, to mention back to Canaanite mythology again, the reason why we in the OTA, the reason why we prefer to use Canaanite, Phoenician, pre-biblical God, goddesses and gods, like primarily Baal and Astarte, El and Mother Asherat, and all. The reason why we prefer to use those more so than the Greek, although the European magicians, you know, who were our forefathers, like Ficino and Campanella and these individuals, they preferred to use the classical forms. And the reason why we like to use the Canaanite forms is because they go better with the Kabbalah. And what happened in the later days of the Renaissance, of Renaissance magic, as it began to phase into the Rosicrucian period, that's when the Hebrew Kabbalah was integrated with the Hermetic system. And that's when we really, the Tree of Life as a master mandala came into use, and that's when it became the roadmap for plotting magical operations and the roadmap of the planets within. So we prefer to go back earlier than classical Greek and Roman, and into the what we would call the Canaanite and the Phoenician mythology, and so it goes right much much better with the Kabbalah. It works much better because it is essentially pre-biblical. It really is, For instance, the primary god and goddess that we have in the Canaanite Phoenician mythology is El, and just A, that's Aleph Lamed. We pronounce it El, and it just means God. That's basically what it means. But also, A, it's Aleph Lamed. It's two letters. And the Aleph, if you turn it up on its pointed end, it looks like a bull. It has two, it has a cross, you know, it's a V, if you can visualize it, it's a V with a stroke through the bottom of it, and then a couple of what looks like a couple of horns sticking out, then a couple of ears hanging down, and this is it's an A. It's basically, it's an upside down A. But if you recall, what did God say? Put no other God before me, you know, and then Jesus said, I am the first and the last, the Alpha and the Omega. So that and bull, and El was referred to as Bull El, and he was often pictured as a bull. And there's a lot of symbolism in that, a symbolism that where the bull is the beginning of the zodiac, and of course that's where our zodiac begins. It begins in Taurus, in Aldebaran, in the bullseye. That's where the zodiac gets starts. So the bull, Taurus, and I have a very very close relationship with a wonderful Taurus lady, so this is, you know, and like Robert Graves, said that you want to find God, that's sitting right next to me. Okay, so that's where the zodiac begins, connection that goes through all mythology. Now, believe it or not, and you can believe this or not, but most scholars do, the Greek, classical Greek goddess of love, Aphrodite, Venus, in the Roman version, Aphrodite in the Greek version, comes directly from Canaan. Aphrodite is Astarte. And she definitely is the Canaanite goddess of love. And she's not the only one that comes over. Hephaestus, the Greek blacksmith god, is Kusor of the Canaanites. He's the blacksmith, and he's also Tubal-Cain in the Bible. So behind the Bible, these gods lie behind the Bible too. This is very important. El or Al is not Jehovah. Now the rabbis following Moses, the rabbis tried to equate Jehovah with El, either that or move him above El, but that never did really work. And most of the tribes of Israel, the so-called lost tribes, who were never lost, they were the ones that stayed there, and the other three tribes got carried away. But so the lost tribes were never lost. But the lost tribes all were, many of them were Canaanite and Phoenician tribes. They worshipped El. They worshipped El. And, of course, Melchizedek was a priest of El and the Most High God. El was the God of Abraham until Moses came along, and at that point the God that spoke to Moses was Jehovah, it has been said that he was a son of El. Whether or not that works, I don't know, but some biblical scholars think that's the case. Anyway, in Canaanite mythology, El was the supreme god. He was like Zeus. In fact, he was cognate with Zeus, or Ea in the Sumerian. And he had a Mount Olympus. And Mount Zaphon, and they had a mountain up in the Lebanon area where Mount Zaphon, where the gods had their palace, and El's wife, Jehovah didn't have a wife, but El had a wife, Lady Asherah of the Sea, who was worshipped in many cases, especially in Byblos, she was worshipped over him, and in this case, the sea, Asherah of the sea, meant the depths of outer space and the sea, and so she was the eternal. She was the eternal goddess, and he's the father of the gods, and. Interestingly enough, El was referred to as the compassionate. Yahweh, Jehovah, never got that appellation. He was never called compassionate, whereas El, the original Father God, was considered to be compassionate. But he let the minor gods. He let the minor pantheon. Baal, Astarte, Anath, and the rest of these, and Kusor, and the rest of these Canaanite gods, he let them kind of run things down on earth, but he was an over god who was compassionate, so consequently, Whereas Jehovah was a war god, and Jehovah preferred to be called Jealous. That was the name he wanted to have. So consequently, El is really, from a standpoint of having an all father god, El is really kind of better to have than if you want a god that's supreme. And El does work better. And you can remember that half the books of the Bible are actually leaning toward El more so than YHVH. And consequently, you're certainly okay not to use YHVH in Kabbalistic operations if you don't want to. And we don't, so we prefer to use Tetragrammaton based on the three mother letters. And we find that it works just as well. And, you know, actually, when you get down to it, it's probable, I believe, and I think there are others who also go along with this, that Jesus of Nazareth was really trying to bring El back into the temple to declare El as the original father. And if you read the Gospels and Jesus' teaching with that in mind, it seems to resonate. And because although I think he had to be very careful about it, because at that time there was not a fusion between the two. And this seems to be the case, and this is what we would prefer to think, that that Jesus was, as Paul said several times, a priest after the order of Melchizedek. And Melchizedek certainly was Melchizedek, by the way, means priest king. And Melchizedek was originally gave the first communion to Abraham, and Melchizedek was certainly a priest of El. So this of course equates, if you want to equate this with Greek mythology, El relates to Zeus, and of course Astarte becomes Aphrodite, and Hera would be Lady Asherat. But let's go a little further here and talk about heroes that became gods. Now, it's often been theorized by scholars of mythology, that most gods, most national or ethnic gods, most of them in mythology were originally heroes. They were originally heroic leaders of their people, who after thousands of years of telling stories about these heroes, and a good example of this would be Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan has become like a god in Mongolia, and that eventually these heroes, these heroic leaders and all they eventually become deified. And their adventures become like allegorical mythology, in this case, where I'm going to mention one of the most famous, and recently, it has become quite a subject for Hollywood films, is Heracles or Hercules, and Hercules is an example of a hero who probably was at one time a real person. But how long ago that was, we have no way of even guessing, because Hercules or Heracles is one of these characters and gods, deities, who came over from the Phoenician and the Canaanite on over to Greece. And the original Hercules was Melkart in Phoenicia, in Tyre, and his labors were people referred to as the conquering of the 12 beasts. Well, that is a pretty short, not exactly completely accurate, but a pretty short description of the labors of Hercules, because, as you recall, Hercules goes around and has to perform 12 rather dangerous tasks, and most of them involve conquering some sort of a beast, the lion, and then he wears the lion skin, and so he has various beasts that he overcomes and various tasks he has to do. Now, originally Hercules was a Phoenician demigod, and he was the god of the city of Tyre, and in fact, Melkart pretty much translates as the god of the place, and he was depicted in the temple as going around and performing these labors around the zodiac, or conquering the beasts of the heavens. Now, if you suspect that this had something to do with Mithraism, you're probably right. And Mithraism and Hermetic, the Hermetic Initiatic Code and Mithraic Initiatic Code, probably all goes back to that temple in Tyre. Now, let me just recount something, an amazing story that very, very few people know about, and relating to this and how this was. Alexander the Great, who we are all familiar with, and Alexander the Great came back from Persia and was going to march all the way down from Lebanon, all the way along the coast, all the way down and conquer Egypt. That was his plan. Well, he started marching down the coast, and he got across from Tyre. Now, Tyre was a fortified island. The Phoenicians liked to build their cities on islands, because that way they were safer. And like they had, it was like they had a moat around a castle. You know, the people on shore couldn't get at them unless they came over in boats. They were easy to defend, and then their harbors were inside. Their harbors were actually inside their fortifications. So that's the way they liked to build their cities whenever they had a chance. Well, Tyre was that way, so they built the whole city on an island, and it was fortified with an enclosed harbor. Well, they had a famous temple of Melkart in Tyre, which one of my esteemed colleagues believes was actually the real temple of Solomon, was actually the temple of Melkart. Well, whether or not it was, we do know that from the Bible that Hiram of Tyre, the king of Tyre, helped King Solomon, build his temple in Jerusalem, and even loaned him an architect, Hiram Abiff, who was part Jewish and part Phoenician, to actually design the temple and supervise this building. Well, now, before the Temple of Melkart, they had a couple of pillars. One of them was green and was translucent, and it could be seen. It was almost like a lighthouse. It could be seen from out to sea. So when the Phoenician traders came sailing in, they looked for that pillar, especially after dark. They looked for the green pillar in front of the temple, and they sighted on that and came on into the harbor. Now, in the temple, this was the temple of Hercules now, or their version of Hercules, Melkart. And Alexander considered this so important that he camped his whole army across from the island of Tyre. And he sent a message over to the king of Tyre, and he said, I would like to come over and visit your temple and make a sacrifice to Heracles or to Melkart. And, well, the king, of course, received the message, and he took it over to the priests in the temple. And the priests wrote back to Alexander, and they said, well, no, we can't let you come over here, and we can't let you in the temple, but what we will do is we will come over to your side, over to the shore, and we will erect an altar to Melkart, and you can make your sacrifice there. Well, Alexander was convinced that he was God, and he conquered enough land where he thought he proved it. So he was very offended by this, and he was really, really upset by this. And so he told his soldiers, all right, we're going to get to roll up your sleeves, and we're going to build a causeway all the way over to Tyre. And we're going to, then once we get this causeway built, we're going to march over there and we're going to take it. And so they did. They all stopped soldiering and started being engineers, and they proceeded to fill in all the way across this isthmus, this channel, they proceeded to fill in this great big mall, and they made a causeway. And when the causeway was finished, they marched over and they took the city. And they then, and this is the part that is absolutely amazing, they took the city and they took every single initiate of the temple of Melkart and crucified them, because they wouldn't let Alexander in. Of course, obviously, he got in. Now, what's the significance of this? Well, the significance is that Alexander was changing. Not only was Alexander changing what he was literally doing was making the zodiac. From that point on, the zodiac did not start at Aldebaran, at the bullseye. It didn't start there anymore. After that, it started with Aries, because that represented Alexander. And so this was what he was really doing, was in a sense he was performing what do they call it in Mithraism? A toreoctomy. He was killing the bull, and so he became, even though he wasn't Mithra, but he did the Mithriatic thing. He killed the bull at that point, and from then on, the zodiac started with Alexander with Aries, and he carried that on down, conquered Egypt, started a dynasty down there, and one of his successors, Ptolemy, codified this age of Aries, and that's today where our zodiac starts as a result of that, of Alexander's being told that he wouldn't be allowed to come into the temple. But all of this is part and parcel of our subject tonight, because we're not only talking about Heracles as a character in Phoenician mythology, in Greek mythology, in Mithriatic ritual, and everything else. But we got Alexander, who was himself supposedly a living god, and these characters in history and in mythology, they are all part of our Western esoteric tradition, and they all relate to it. And we have to, we should, as we practice magic and as we go through initiations and all, we should actually incorporate all of these elements into our magical psyche, into our magical personality. We should fan these things, and we should make them ours, and make them part of our makeup. Now, let me point out another aspect of this that relates to what we're saying about these Phoenician and Greek and these god forms. I've mentioned several times on this show, and I know that you, those of you who have studied our legendas, are aware that of a group of people called the North Sabaeans, or the Sabaeans of Haran. Now, they're very important to this subject, and the reason why they are is this. Haran is still there, although the Turks keep saying they're going to flood it and to make a reservoir over it. But Haran was a city built by at the time of ancient Babylon. It was built between the headwaters of the Tigris and the Euphrates River. It's right over the Turkish border from Syria. And right now, it's not that's not a comfortable place to be because, you know, you might get hit by friendly or unfriendly fire if you hang right at that area too much. But in ancient times, Haran was referred to as the city of the stargazers, and this is where the Babylonian and Median Babylonian Magi. This is where that Magi sect eventually settled in, and they lived up there in Haran, and it was a walled city. And the main thing that these folks did was they were astronomical and astrological magicians. They studied the heavens. They had temples that were like planetary observatories, and they plotted the heavens, and they were very astute astrologers, and they were ceremonial magicians, and so each one of these planets to them was a god, and they named the planets after the gods, the Babylonian, and it was, you know, what came down from the days of Gilgamesh, and that's Ishtar and Nergal and Ea, and so that pantheon, but the Sabaeans, they didn't call themselves Sabaeans until later. We'll get into that for just a minute. These Haranians were very knowledgeable about what was going on with other cultures. And they were especially, you know, the Babylonian and the Median cultures. They were very well read. They are very well educated, and they knew what the Egyptians had written and whatever. They were scholars, and along with being astrologers, really really good astrologers and magicians. Now, so they maintained all of this lore, and Abraham, if you recall from the Bible, Abraham came through when he left Ur. He went up and spent time in Haran before he went into Canaan and received his dispensation from Melchizedek down in Canaan. So what happens now is that the Haranians stay there and perpetuate this astrological stellar religion of theirs, planetary religion, and keep their astrological studies going. And this all the way up through the time of Jesus and all the way through to the rise of Muhammad. And then when the Arabs began their conquest and they began to move out convert people to Islam by force and whatever. This emir, this Arab emir with an army, surrounded Haran, and the Haranians, you know, came out and tried to negotiate with him. And the emir said, "Well, who are you people?" And they said, "Well, we're Haranians." The emir told him, he said, "Look, what do you worship?" And they said, "Well, we worship the gods, you know." Well, that's not, they mean you're pagans. And they didn't quite know what a pagan was, but anyway, they, you know, they agreed they worship the gods. So the emir said, "Now, I'm going to be back in a year from now. I'm going to come back this way. And by that time, you are going to have to be, you're going to have to be Christians, Jews, Muslims, or Sabaeans. You have four choices. And if you're not one of these religions, then you are going to either convert to Islam, or we'll put you to the sword." So that was their ultimatum. And off the emir went. So the Haranians all took counsel. I've gone over this before in other programs, but because this program is important to us right now, I'll go over it again. The Haranians took counsel, and they said, "Well, I think we don't want to be Jewish. We don't want to be Christian. These are too restrictive, and we certainly don't want to be Muslims, because we've looked into their thing, and they don't appreciate anything except their book, and that's it." So he said, "They well, what's a Sabaean?" Okay, well, the Sabaeans were, as they those that knew told them, the Sabaeans were the Queen of Sheba's people. That was down in southern Arabia, down where Yemen is now. And they were very, very civilized before their great dam broke. That was a couple hundred years before Muhammad. But they were very, very civilized. Well, and they also had an astrological religion, and very similar to the Haranians. So the Haranians said, "Well, if they're exempted from forced conversion, let's be Sabaeans, because they're pretty close to what we are." And so they agreed on, they decided that's what they do. But then they thought, "Well, we're going to have to get some Sabaean books." Well, they couldn't find any Sabaean books. And the Sabaeans did have a language and all of that, so maybe there were Sabaean books for them to find, but they didn't find any. So what they ended up doing was they ended up taking the Hermetic Corpus from Alexandria. They took that. They had copies of that, and they had a copy of what is now known as Ethiopian Enoch. They had a copy of that too, and so between the Hermetic Corpus from Alexandria and the Book of Enoch, they said, "Okay, we're Sabaeans, and these are our scriptures, and so we're ready for this guy when he comes back." Well, the emir never did come back, but they decided to be Sabaeans anyway. So that's what they called themselves. And then the interesting thing about this is, then they began to develop these invocations, and this comes down to us in ceremonial magic, and it has to do with tonight's theme. They then collected. Across comparative mythology, they studied everybody's different name for the gods, for all the planets. And if you read, the Picatrix, and of course you read the Picatrix, we got the Sabaean invocations in there, you'll see what I'm talking about. When they start to invoke a planet, or the goddess of a planet, or the god of a planet, they're going to give the names in Greek, they're going to give the names in Arabic, they're going to give the names in Coptic. They will go through all of these different languages that they can think of, where they've collected the names of all of the different from all of the mythologies, and that's come down to us in ceremonial magic. Now, interestingly enough, in fact, we still use some of those Picatrix invocations, or what's very similar to them. Anyway, the upshot of all of this was that they became a hermetic center. So in Europe, during the Renaissance, when these people lasted, they lasted all the way up until the Mongols, the Iranians, kept their hermetic center going all the way up till the Mongol hordes started swarming. And that's when they had to leave, and not just the Mongol hordes, but also the wells dried up, you know. So they left Iran at that point, and then because they were Sabaeans, they were exempt from forced conversion to Islam. They made their living as astrologers and magicians in the service of the caliphs and the sultans of the Islamic world. These were the magicians of the Arabian Nights, the Sabaeans from Haran. And they also gave us a lot of Solomonic ceremonial magic. You can trace right back to the Sabaeans of Haran. And the idea of using all of these different pagan gods, including their, you know, even some versions of our Canaanite Phoenician mythology, so this is you know, part and parcel of the mythological figures in magic, and of course also when we integrated the Kabbalah into magic, then these gods got into the Kabbalah. Now, interestingly enough, some Kabbalists, some Hebrew Kabbalists, will tell you that planets and astrology don't matter in Kabbalah. That is baloney. If you study the Zohar, you will find out that astrology and planetary magic is all through the Zohar, and it's in fact, you might even say that. I know the Zohar is supposed to be a mystical commentary on the Pentateuch, but I think it actually, there's more astrology and ancient mythology that influences the Zohar, perhaps more than a commentary on the Pentateuch, at least the way I look at it. But anyway, the Sabaeans were teaching classes in magic and astrology in Spanish universities. And the book The Picatrix, that's where the book The Picatrix comes from, is probably it comes out of those Spanish universities. This is where European magicians during the Middle Ages, right after the Crusades, this is where they went to get an education, was in Spanish universities before the Christian Spaniards threw the Muslim Spaniards out, and when they threw them out, they threw out the Jews and the Sabaeans, and everybody else went along with them. But our gods, our Canaanite god forms, work very, very well with this Picatrix type system, because, as I say, these people were the magicians of the Arabian Nights. And Solomon, as I'm sure most of you are aware, Solomon was Jewish, but whether or not his concept of God was Jehovah or El, I suspect it was more El than Jehovah, because when he went to Hiram of Tyre, the king of Tyre, and said, "I want to build a temple, and will you help me?" And Hiram of Tyre said, "Praise the Lord, yes, I will." Well, obviously, Hiram of Tyre was praising El, and so I think that Solomon probably, because he wanted to unite all of Israel, and most of the Israelite tribes were worshiping El anyway, so I think they built that original temple to El. Now that's one of the reasons why Jesus wanted to restore it, you know, to the original Father God, El. Now that's my take on it, but you know, some of the others might think otherwise. I don't know, but I tend to think that Solomon was primarily building the temple for El, And yet we know Solomon also built a temple to Astarte. And so the goddess Astarte was Solomon's goddess. Now, why didn't the original Hebrews have a goddess? Why didn't Yahweh have a consort? He should have, but he didn't. This is when they began. I think this is the, one of the thing reasons why the Old Testament is kind of anti-female. And because there seems to be Jehovah seems to be just very, very, you know, much, it's very, very patriarchal. And in some instances it still is, but they had a goddess, and that goddess of course eventually became in the Kabbalistic terms the Shekinah, which is the feminine side of God, which descends. So they, in a sense, the Kabbalists, not being able to have a goddess per se, they created a sort of a hermaphrodite version of Jehovah, which had a female side called the Shekinah, which came down. And yet, there's a very interesting book called The Hebrew Goddess by a scholar by the name of Raphael Patti, and I very strongly recommend this book, which shows you that they really were the ancient Hebrews really did quite often slide into goddess worship, and the goddess that they really seemed to like the most was Astarte, but then their leaders did not, and so Astarte eventually became demonized, and so the only way we could get her back was to go down to Tartarus and bring her back up and say, well, goddess, we're bringing you back up again, and of course her symbol is the pentagram, and that's because Venus describes a perfect pentagram when she goes around the zodiac, as I'm sure some of you have heard. So anyway, the idea of the Sabaeans with all their different god forms relating to each one of these planets, and these planets, of course, relating to spheres in the tree of life, and all this. And Solomon, you know, being a secret worshiper of Astarte, this all goes into what we call Solomonic ceremonial magic. Now, one of the things that I'm sure that comes up to mind is that, well, Solomon and the building of the temple is all, that's a lot of Masonic symbolism. Well, yes, it is, but the magical aspect of that is that Solomon, according to the magical tradition, Solomon used his command of the spirits, and the spirits helped him build the temple. Now, this is a Hermetic tradition, not necessarily a biblical one, but it also has an analog in the Arabian side of things too, and this is why Solomon or Suleiman is kind of the Arabic Merlin. He's the great magician in the Arabian Nights, and you find him mentioned quite a bit in the Arabian Nights as the master of the jinn, and his magic ring, he can control the jinn. And of course, Solomon supposedly sealed up these demons after he got them to work for him. He sealed them up in crucibits or jars and sealed them with his sacred seal and threw them into lakes and into seas and all. And you know, then somebody digs one up on the beach and opens it up, and out comes the genie and says, I've been in this jug for 5,000 years and I, the first 1,000 years, I said, anybody release me, I would do all this and that for them, give them anything. And then the next 1,000 years, I said, the first person to release me, I'm going to squash them flat or something like that. Anyway, though, then you got to talk a genie out of stepping on you and see if you can get him back to giving you something. But this all comes from the idea that Solomon was the great magician and the master of the jinn. Now, these spirits are all of them in Solomon, that worked for Solomon, the jinn, all of them were originally some form of pagan entity. I can also say this. Some angels, some of the Hebrew angels, some of the angels that have come down to us were originally also pagan gods and goddesses. And so there's been a lot of transformation of angels and spirits and pagan gods into demons that frankly, a magician has the right to use these. We feel like we have, in ceremonial magic, especially in Solomonic magic, we feel we have the right to use these bound spirits, the ones that Solomon bound and whatever. We feel we have the right to use them, and we use them respectfully, but to help us accomplish things. And that's also a tradition ceremony. And we don't feel that is in any way making us demonic or devilish or anything like that. No, these spirits have been bound by Solomon. They're controlled by the angelic forces, and we can use them, and we call upon them, and that's part of the magician's armamentarium. So this explains, or should give you a reason why Solomon is the master magician, and why he's considered the master magician. And also, too, you should understand that the whole business of ceremonial magic, the way it's practiced, is essentially comes down to us from pagan traditions that have been translated into Kabbalistic angelic Kabbalistic formulas so the whole idea is you're supposed to be, if you're a Solomonic ceremonial magician, you are supposed to be you have God on your side. You are supposed to be a God-fearing, loyal Christian or Jew or Muslim. Or you're supposed to be, and use that power and that faith and that strength to control these rebellious forces and these earlier pagan forms that. I want to make it clear frankly, we're not. There's nothing satanic or diabolical about any of this. This is and a real ceremonial magician does not use these Canaanite or these Solomonic spirits to hurt anybody, but he may use them to help himself or to help his family or whatever. He can do that, but he doesn't use them for evil purposes because he is a God-fearing individual, and he's not supposed to do that. And if he does fear God, he's not going to. So consequently, this is not, as I said, it's not anything satanic or anything like that. And we certainly don't make... If you're a real Renaissance type magician, you don't make pacts with any of these spirits. You may bind them for certain purposes. You don't make pacts with them. They work for you. You don't work for them. And so consequently, once this is understood, I think that the idea that people who do this sort of thing are doing black magic will go away. For one thing, if you're going to bring these ancient archetypes, and I use a Jungian expression there, if you're going to bring these ancient archetypes up in a mirror, and then tell them to go out and hurt somebody, you're liable to get hurt yourself more than whoever it is you're trying to hurt. Now, so that's something to keep in mind. And it kind of keeps us on the straight and narrow. And the whole idea here of resurrecting the pagan traditions and keeping them alive goes back to the idea that Hermes himself said. He said, man creates the gods of the earth sphere, but the gods of the zodiac are eternal. Now, so he's telling you right there, what he's saying is that the gods of the earth sphere, the gods that you have inside yourself, really belong to the human race. They are part of you. And he's right, because if you look at all of these different pagan pantheons, especially the Greek and the Greek gods, look at all their adventures and all of their, they had regular soap operas, and they conspired against each other, and they fought each other, and they were really, Giordano Bruno said about them, they were a bunch of hooligans. They really just about every nasty, tricky, dirty thing you can think of, these old Greek gods did to man and to each other. So they have all their archetypes in our psyche, and we all have them. And so you need to become the masters of these archetypes. You need to master them. And we use the power of the good God and in Jesus and even, although we don't use Jehovah, we use El, but use the positive power and the angels. And, of course, the angels are representatives of God. So we use them to keep these rebellious forces and these forces of id and ego, and to keep these in check and to learn from them and make them work for us. And I think that's the reason why these old pagan gods. And especially of the ones behind the Bible and the Canaanite mythology. This is why they work for us, and this is why they are important to keep them within us and use them and use them to perfect ourselves. Okay, that should just about what I have to say about on this subject. So be sure and tune in next week, and we will talk more about magic and the various aspects of the Hermetic tradition which go into it. And until then, we'll see you, and good magic.